Why would I allow my body to be away from estrogen? Why would I do this to myself? You know, why would I let myself suffer a little? You know, like, why do you have to, why are we waiting until people are symptomatic? This is a safe, helpful medication for the vast majority of patients. There's this pervasive narrative that estrogen is harmful. We have it our whole lives until menopause. It's not inherently carcinogenic.
And then we suffer.
Yeah, like, as long as it's suffer. Balanced with progesterone, yeah. It is not carcinogenic.
Hello, my buddies, and welcome back to another episode of Better with Dr. Stephanie. It's me, your host, Dr. Stephanie Estima. And if you have been confused about hormone replacement therapy or menopause hormone therapy, this episode is going to clear everything up for you. My guest today is Dr. Mary Claire Haver. She is a board certified in obstetrics and gynecology and is a certified culinary medicine specialist from Tulane University. She's a Louisiana State University Medical Center graduate and completed her obstetrics and gynecology residency at the University of Texas Medical Branch. She's also a certified menopause specialist through the Menopause Society. So we talked about all the things that you are wanting to hear about. So we talked about the non-classical or non-obvious signs of perimenopause and menopause. We talked about the fallacies from the Women's Health Initiative and why some of those fallacies persist today and what you can do about it. So it's one thing to complain about a really badly done study, but what happens if your doctor also is going on the data from that very badly done study? We offer some tips and action items and some resources for you. We talk about menopause hormone therapy or HRT. So we talk about estrogen plus progesterone. We talk about all different types of therapies, whether it's oral or creams or compounded pellets, gosh, all the things, lozenges. We talk about your expectations for resolution of symptoms. We talk about whether you are someone who is postmenopausal. So maybe you or your mother is 70, 80 years old and has sort of missed that ideal window. Can she still benefit from hormone replacement therapy? And then we also talk about the opposite. So if you are a 46 or a 47 or a 48 year old who is not necessarily feeling any symptoms yet, should you prophylactically, as a preventative measure, get on menopause hormone therapy? And she answers all of those and much more on today's episode. I'm going to ask that you share this with every woman that you love. She could be 25, 45, or 75. Everybody's going to benefit from my conversation today with Dr. Mary Claire Haver. And I hope that you enjoy it as much as I had having it with her. So, on to the show. I am incredibly bullish on sauna as a therapy for recovery, heart health, and overall aging well. I personally decided on an infrared sauna from Sunlighten because of the range of far wavelengths and near infrared wavelengths that it offers. Saunas help with detoxification and rejuvenation to rid your body of toxins. It helps with heart health by improving circulation, reducing blood pressure, and helping keep the arteries supple. It helps with muscle recovery by easing the tension and soreness to recover faster, and of course, stress reduction. With the warmth and the relaxation of sitting in a sauna, it's crucial for hormonal balance and achieving a state of well-being necessary for a strong physique and a strong mind. If you visit sunlighten.com/better and use code better to get a discount, that is sunlighten, sunlighten.com/better, and use code better at checkout. Clinical studies have shown that collagen strengthens our bones, joints, ligaments. It improves our gut lining as well as improves our skin health. And unfortunately, as we age, the amount of collagen that we produce and that we store declines. Complete Collagen from Equip Foods contains only one ingredient, the only one that you need, grass-fed bovine collagen peptides. Every serving of grass-fed collagen contains 15 grams of collagen peptides that you can add to any drink, any meal. There's no chemicals, no preservatives, no artificial flavors that spike your blood sugar. It is literally the easiest way to support healthy joints and tissues and to support recovery after an injury. I put one scoop of Equip Foods collagen and one scoop of their pre-workout in my water prior to my early morning workouts. And I'll have a post-exercise shake, of course, with their Prime Protein. That's another product from Equip Foods that I love. So if you head on over to equipfoods.com/better, use code better at checkout, which is going to give you 20% off of your entire cart. Everything that's in your order, you're getting 20% off with the code BETTER. So again, that's equipfoods.com/better and use code BETTER, that's B-E-T-T-E-R, at checkout for 20% off. And we are live. Dr. Mary Claire Haver, I am thrilled to welcome you to the show. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we are going to talk about all about hormones, all about menopause. What are some of the changes? What are some of the things we can expect? Mm-hmm. Because I think that any good doctor worth her salt is going to be able to predict for you what is down the road for you before you get there and then have the tools for you once you arrive. So the demographic that listens to the show, perimenopausal women, menopausal mm-hmm. women looking for solutions, very familiar with something like a hot flash or a night sweat as like a classic
right.
sign and symptom of menopausal or that menopausal transition. I thought that you and I might get a little more granular and we could talk about some of the more obvious and not so obvious signs and symptoms that you might be in perimenopause mm-hmm. and then of course in menopause.
Sure. Let's do it.
Let's do it. So what are some of the more not so obvious signs that you might be in perimenopause?
So when we look at the true effect of the loss of estrogen on the human body, it turns out perimenopause and menopause are way more than just your stereotypical hot flash, night sweat, and cycle disruption. Okay. Everyone's going to have cycle disruption. 85% of us will have some kind of a vasomotor symptom like a hot flash, night sweat, etc. But what's kind of left behind in a lot of the literature and in common practice and common knowledge is we have estrogen receptors everywhere in our body and every single organ system can be affected. So did you know 80% of women have musculoskeletal syndrome of menopause with sudden onset of musculoskeletal pain without injury? Did you know that 90% of us will have sleep disruptions of some type? Sometimes it's due to the vasomotor symptom, but some women with no hot flashes just wake up at 3 a.m.
Yeah.
So if we go head to toe, we see, depending on who you read, a 4-to-1 to 8-to-1 increase, you know, 4-fold to 8-fold increase of mental health disorders across the menopause transition. We see cognitive changes. Lisa Moscone's book was just released, The Menopause Brain, and she is a neuroscience researcher who did PET scans on brains of women throughout the menopause journey, and it's shocking. You know, the brain completely rewires through the menopause transition. So we see loss of executive functioning. We see difficult, you know, finding your words. We see women quitting their jobs because they don't feel like they can operate at that same level anymore. Women think that they're having early dementia from menopause. So let's move down. In the inner ear, we see vertigo and we see ringing in the ears, tinnitus, you know, much higher in the menopausal population than the non-menopausal population. We see palpitations out of nowhere with no, you know, complete normal cardiac workup, but unexplainable palpitations, which are actually related to the menopause. We go down to the lungs. We see new onset of asthma across the menopause transition, and it's an atypical asthma that tends to be only women suffer, and it doesn't respond to the typical medications, or we see worsening asthmatic disease. So if we go down to the gut, we see tremendous changes in our gut. We see the gut microbiome. The Zoe Predict study looked at women's gut microbiome through the menopause transition. We lose diversity. We lose the biome completely shifts to that of a man's without our sex hormones. And we see skin changes, nail changes, of course, hair loss. Most people know that. We start growing hair in places we don't want it, losing hair in places we do want it. We see the frozen shoulder was the one that makes everyone crazy. You know, that's really, you know, loss of function of certain joints. So it goes on and on and on. Now, when we go internal, what age-matched women, if we took a group of women in your demographic, and we match them with, I'm not menopausal yet, but I am, but we're the same age. Women in menopause are 2 to 3 times more likely to have metabolic disease and metabolic syndrome than a woman who is premenopausal at the same age. And so we see worsening hypertension, we see worsening cholesterol, we see increasing risk of cardiovascular disease. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. So every time I post about this on social media and I'll say, how's your cholesterol? The world goes crazy because they're like, look, I've changed nothing. No diet changes, no exercise changes. and my cholesterol shot up 30, 40.
Isocaloric, like still having the same calories that I was when I was 35. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Plus, yeah. And then the what brings most people to my office the quickest is the visceral fat, is the right. abdominal, you know, the body composition changes. And so sudden increase of fat deposition in the abdominal cavity. So they see their waistline suddenly increasing.
Right. And I think that that can be, I mean, we're going to dig into that a little bit, but I think the one of the things that a lot of women will say is, I've been doing the same, eating the same foods. I've been mm-hmm. doing the same workouts. And over all and of a sudden, all the weight has like moved from my thighs and my butt where I, you know, I have kind of a general disdain for that, but now it's in my belly, right? Like right. now it's like, now this is the, you know, this is the real problematic fat that is going to now negatively impact the liver, negative all the organs where we're seeing that fat accumulation.
They've measured it across the menopause transition. That visceral fat goes from 7% to 30, 24 to 30.
Wow. 7%
with no changes in diet and exercise. You know, everything is the same.
Yeah.
And it's a 7 to 30% change.
That is crazy. I mm-hmm. was not aware of that stat. Okay. So we have a 23, 24.
So let's say, I mean, that's basically yeah. a 3X, you know,
yeah.
increase in visceral fat across the menopause transition.
Yeah. And we're going to talk about your new book, The New Menopause. Mm-hmm. And I will also just say the Galveston diet here is also very appropriate, right? So when we are thinking about a reduction, and I know that there was, you know, I don't like to necessarily talk a lot about drama, but I know that there's been a lot of, we'll say, resistance online to this idea that you can spot reduce visceral fat, that there can be, you know, it's not necessarily the same, you know, eat less, move more.
Right.
That is not necessarily what's going to get rid of the visceral fat. We can be thinking about changing the macro composition of the diet in right. order to therapeutically address
visceral
something
fat.
Like visceral fat accumulation, mm-hmm. correct?
And that's, it meets a lot of resistance from people who are really entrenched in the calories in, calories out kind of space. Now, calories are important. Of course they are. Every scientist knows that. But visceral fat is metabolically active, is very, very different, and responds to hormone changes way more actively than our subcutaneous fat does. And so, sure, if I locked you in a cage and starved you, you would lose visceral fat, but you'd also lose muscle mass. You'd probably lose your mind, you know. But fortunately, there actually have been studies done for women in menopause, specifically looking at them and habits and ways that decrease the amount of visceral fat. And it's pretty fascinating. And none of them include caloric restriction.
Right, right. So, I mean, caloric restriction has its place. I think it is a
sure.
tool. And to your point, I think that we can also be considering macronutrients. Like both of those truths can coexist. Like we can think about calories and we can think about maybe, you know, and the Galveston diet. I wrote a very similar book to you called The Betty Body, where we're thinking about a therapeutic intervention of a reduction of carbohydrates, maybe mm-hmm. a higher fat, higher protein as a therapeutic intervention to reduce that visceral fat. And then we can move on to other tools once that's been corrected. Mm-hmm. I've asked this to Dr. Lisa Moscone. She was also on the show, on the podcast. Yeah, I love her. I love her. Yes.
She's changing the world.
She really is. And she does it with such grace and class and so firm and so grounded. So, and her, I think her book at the time of this recording, I think she just made the New York Times bestseller list, which is so well deserved. One of the things that we were talking about on the show is the thing, you know, menopause in and of itself. So we've talked about some of the classic, non-classic signs of menopause, but it puzzles, you know, evolutionary biologists insofar as like, why does this even exist? Like, why is it, you know, and we were sort of poking fun at Darwin a little bit because we're like, you know, Darwin got a lot of things wrong. And one of them was his theory on menopause and why women age, because it was very sort of, it's just because of modern medicine and that's why we live longer. And so she presented something called the grandmother effect, mm-hmm. which I know you're familiar with. And I wanted to just pose the same question to you and maybe elaborate on some of your thoughts in terms of why do we go through menopause and is there an evolutionary advantage, disadvantage? Like why does this happen in the human species?
So there's, you know, the theory, which is just one guy in North Carolina said it one time and it kind of got picked up. It went viral because mm-hmm. no one else could explain it. When you look at ovarian evolutionary biologists and the people who were studying how do we extend the shelf life of the ovary, it's very controversial, the grandmother hypothesis. But it kind of makes sense. The evolutionary advantage might be for community. Typically, evolutionary advantages are for the individual to survive. This is one of the few theories that looks at how it would affect a community. And when we look at whales, grandmothers have, certain species of whales do go through menopause. And that kind of forms a group of individuals who can no longer reproduce, but are still active and become caretakers of their community. And so that was kind of the theory looking at the one species, I forget which type of whale, blue whale, I think. And there's very few species that actually have a menopause, in mammals. And there's like five, and we're one of them. But
there might be giraffes,
other
and like
people,
some snails or
yeah,
something like
giraffes
that.
Yeah. And yeah. The giraffe and a couple of other underwater, species. Mm-hmm. So when you look at, real evolution, we died before menopause. We did not live that long. So there really wasn't a menopause. It was just you died at the end of your reproductive function. Women didn't live much past the age of 40. And they were reproducing a lot younger than we do because of because of how we've evolved as a culture. We have cultural reasons we delay childbearing to our 20s when we could actually reproduce quite easily in our teens, And so that being said, that kind of fuels a thought of why would we intervene if this was the way it was meant to be. But here's the reality. Women live longer than men, up to 6 years for age-matched men. But we spend 20% of our lives in poorer health than a man. And I can tell you, my patients who are coming to me are very upset about this. They're looking at their mothers. They're looking at their, family, what's going on with the older women in the generation. And they're seeing women spending years in bed with dementia, years in bed with frailty, who don't have active, healthy lives. Most women can expect to have the last 10 years of their life to be in very, very poor health. They're living longer. But it's not a health span. It's just a lifespan. And so they're coming to me saying, I don't want that. And what puts people in a nursing home? That they can't think and that they can't move are the two top reasons. Frailty and dementia. And they want to do everything in their power to avoid that. And guess what happens in menopause? The race to those two conditions accelerates. And giving you estrogen will slow that down. Not to negate lifestyle, that is hugely important here. But my patients want to put every tool in their toolkit possible to, get them to the finish line as healthy as possible.
Well, as they should.
They want to die like a man. A man just lives his life and dies, has a heart attack, has a stroke, whatever. And doesn't, not as much as women, have this protracted, long, poor health span where they're miserable and their families have it. I don't want my children to sacrifice their lives, their families, their jobs to come and take care of me. And that's kind of what's happening today.
Right. And it would never be acceptable. It would never be acceptable if that was the story for most men. It would never be acceptable.
Just flip the switch. A man wakes up at 50. He can't sleep because of hot flashes. His pee-pee has shrunk to a sausage size. He can't have sex anymore. It's so painful. He can't think because of brain fog. He's having weird musculoskeletal pain. It would be a national emergency if men had true hypogonadism, and some do, God bless them, hypogonadism. This would not be a discussion. How can you deny women the chance? They may not choose it, and I fully support that. The chance to live the healthiest life possible.
Right. Or how could you justify telling a man, maybe you just need a hobby, or maybe it's just
some wine.
Yeah, exactly. Like, go out with your friends more.
Right. Get some better sleep.
Yeah, he would punch the doctor. He would just
lose weight. Lose some weight.
Yeah, lose some weight. Or this is how it is, honey. This is how it is now when you're 50.
Welcome to the club.
Yeah. Unacceptable. Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about because I hear this all the time in my community around, okay, I get that, menopause happens. It happens for every woman. My doctor won't prescribe me hormones. This is, they're telling me that I'm going to die of a heart attack, of breast cancer, of this, of that, of this. And I've actually done solo episodes on the Women's Health Initiative. So we will link that in the show notes if you want to just, I go line by line. I'm like, look at the age, look at what they were doing, right. Look at the da, 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 da. But I would love for you in your book, in your new book, The New Menopause, you talk about the difference between absolute risk and relative risk. And I think that this is a very important point that I would like to double underline and highlight. So can we talk about the difference between those two things?
So relative risk is a statistical construct where we look at populations, okay? So for example, if I have a condition where 4 out of 1,000 women per year will develop breast cancer, this is actual factual information, by the way. And then if I give her a certain medication, this population, 5 out of 1,000 women will develop this condition if they take the medication. So for going from 4 to 5 is about a 20 to 25% increase in relative risk. What that means, so that's looking at populations, and that is an increase. What that means for the individual patient, that's absolute risk. So I can tell her, if you take this medication, you will have all of these benefits. Your bones will be stronger. Your brain will be stronger. Your risk of cardiovascular disease decreases if we do it in the right window. Your risk of neurological disease will decrease if we do it in the right window. You're less likely to have frozen shoulder, less likely to have broken bones. You're less likely to die from an osteoporotic fracture. But there's a 0.08% or 0.8% chance per year that you would have an increased risk of breast cancer. Are you willing to take that chance?
That's better than saying to someone a 25% or 20%.
And that's all that got reported in the press.
Yeah.
Was 25% increased risk. And it is still pervasive today, though most of that data has been walked back, rescinded from the authors. So most of the claims that they made in 2002 are still stuck in people's minds. It takes, a study was done 17 years for an, you know, new bench research articles to get propagated into routine clinical practice.
Right.
And it's amazing to me that an entire generation of women have been denied access to probably one of the most powerful medications that could improve their health because of one flawed study.
And I think of all the women who were on hormones who were
doing
just
well,
yanked off. Yeah, like this is going to give you breast cancer, girl. Like, got to get off it now, right? And all the suffering that could have been avoided there. Let's also talk a little bit about the drug formulation, because some of the formulations in terms of what was used in, so when did the study come out? Was it 2001? 2002, pardon me. So the drugs that they were using then were not some of the hormone replacement sort of, we'll say, concoctions that are available today. Can you distinguish between some of the ones that were used in the study and the problems maybe with them versus the ones that we have available to us now in 2024? Yeah.
So the main hormone that was being prescribed in 2002 for estrogens, we have estrogens, we have progestogens, and we have androgens, right, as our sex hormones. So the main estrogen that was used was something called conjugated equine estrogen or Premarin. That is actually natural and very bioidentical, but a lot of people have an ethical issue with how it's extracted from the horse. And there's their horses and whatnot. And I don't prescribe it because of that. Now we have estradiol readily available. Estradiol is the hormone that our ovaries used to make, and it's readily available, FDA approved, multiple options, multiple ways to put in your body, pills, patches, gels, sprays, rings. And so that's kind of the estrogen piece of it. Progestogens are more complicated. We have progestins, which are considered to be synthetic. They're basically synthesized in a lab and eventually get into the bloodstream and will bind to the progesterone receptor. But we've actually been able to, and the reason why that happened is progesterone is a huge molecule. And it was really difficult to get a bioavailable form. So lab chemists decided to let's make something that is easily absorbable that'll bind to the receptor and be good enough. And those are where we have dozens and dozens and dozens of synthetic progestins out there, multiple different birth control pill options, different MHT options. Progesterone in and of itself is the body identical form, and it is now really readily available. They've been able to micronize it. So, and then it's really easy to absorb orally. And then for the androgens, which is a really tough one because most doctors, me included, have zero training in how testosterone could be helpful to a woman and how to prescribe it. You know, we all knew about estrogen and progesterone. That's part of our training. But testosterone kind of gets left in the dust. So
the Wild West.
We'll come back to that one. But so today, most of the people like us who use evidence-based medicine are really sticking to what the ovary used to make, which is estradiol and progesterone. And I don't want to say that the other progestins are terrible. Some people don't tolerate, you know, the oil that the progesterone is embedded in the pills. They'll have a reaction or they feel like they have a hangover. So I like having lots of options. But my go-to is estradiol, usually a transdermal form, because oral estrogen works great. We have great effects from it. It's very cheap. But there's a very slight increased risk of blood clots with the oral formulations, and it is dose dependent. So, but we can negate that completely by doing a non-oral form, like a transdermal.
That's the first pass liver. That's because it's going to the
It bumps the clotting factors in the liver.
Yeah.
Progesterone doesn't do that. Now, progesterone really should be given orally because the molecule is huge, like we talked about, and it does not absorb well through the skin. So, any of your listeners who've been given a progesterone cream, and you're on estrogen, you are not really protected against endometrial cancer, you should call your provider and ask to be switched to the oral micronized progesterone. So when you look at the safety data, and the studies are kind of all over the place as far as, when we say safety, everyone means risk of breast cancer or stroke. The best data seems to congregate around, and you can find studies that it's a little more this or a little more that, around estradiol and Premarin. Pretty equal in safety. Ethinyl estradiol is what is in most, it is synthetic and is what is in most birth control pills. Not all, but most. And I can't think of, maybe there's one FDA approved option. Pretty much everyone's using estradiol now in a transdermal form. And then the oral micronized progesterone.
It's time for a radical shift in skincare. I am so over buying products that make big promises and consistently under-deliver. They spend all their money on marketing rather than the actual product itself. No more. I am proud to be partnering with OneSkin. This is a company that is targeting the root cause of skin aging with OS1. This is a novel peptide that targets cellular senescence, one of the root causes of aging. Under various clinical trials, OS1 was shown to decrease senescent cell load in the skin, upregulate genes associated with healthy skin function like collagen and hyaluronic acid, and enhance the activation of cellular repair pathways and increasing epidermal thickness. This company has had rigorous science to back up their claims, and it works. As you know, this year I am doubling down on skincare, and OneSkin is one of the ways that I'm getting my 40-year-old skin to behave like 20-year-old skin. Visit oneskin.co and use code BETTER at checkout to save 15%. That's oneskin.co and use code BETTER at checkout to save 15%.
And so is this, so use the word body identical. I don't know if that was intentional to use the word body.
So bioidentical kind of has this weird, it's more of a marketing term than a medical term. So I'm kind of adopting what the British do. And so body identical is more of a, we're trying to make it more medical terminology. We all know what it means, but I think it's been overhyped. Like a lot of people are under the impression that you must do compounded to get body identical or plant-based or whatever, and that it's somehow safer. And some of these compounded versions have never been tested. They don't have to undergo the same rigorous testing that FDA approved options do. So, you know, I love having compounded options available when the regular FDA ones won't work or I need to go higher dose, lower dose. You know, again, I love having 1,000 tools in my toolkit for my patients, but my go-to is to stick to the FDA approved options when I can.
Okay. So body identical, this is when we are...
So when you hear those terms, just think estradiol and progesterone.
It's just estradiol, but just the mechanism of delivery might be through a cream or a patch or
a trochee. Those pellet things. Yeah.
Right. So, okay. So we talked about creams, patches, oral. When someone first starts on... So let's say we're going to maybe describe the classic... Someone who would classically benefit from going on menopause hormone therapy, what would be the time to value or like the resolution of symptoms? If someone is experiencing sleep disturbances, mood and affect, body composition changes, hot flashes, night sweats. How long after commencing therapy do we expect to see?
I'm glad you asked that. So we don't know. Those studies haven't been done. All we know is how long for hot flashes. That's really the only data. And we don't know what dose is the most effective for X, Y, and Z condition because the studies are done. Is she on hormone therapy of any type usually or not? When we look at observational studies, they're just saying, was she on hormones or not? They don't look at dose. They don't look at, very few data are stratifying, results based on type or formulation. And so we know that in 3 to 4 weeks, her hot flashes should resolve if she's on the right dose. If it's not resolved by then, go ahead and increase her dose of estrogen at least to see if that'll help. Progesterone alone can help for hot flashes as well, but you have to go pretty high. But as far as mood, I have patients who say the next day, I have patients who say it took a few months, before they really saw. When you think about how the estrogen receptor works, once we go through menopause and you don't have estrogen in your body, we start down-regulating those receptors.
Right.
When we reintroduce estrogen, it takes a while to up-regulate those receptors again and then have them bound and then the down pathway of inflammation lowering and everything. So I'm usually telling patients, if they have hot flashes, that's easy for me because then I can use that to see at least is that therapeutic and probably everything else will fall in line. But for the others, we have to be patient and it is a lot of trial and error with the patients.
And do you find that there must be a lot of bioindividuality as well? Like you said,
absolutely. And how you absorb and how you react and how you, So again, these are intense conversations. It's a lot of trial and error. I tell my patients to be patient and that we will figure this out together. But we may have to try a few things to figure out what's going to work for you. And what works now may not work in 5 years, in a year. It's a constant tweaking. But I really go with symptoms and not arbitrary blood levels.
I really like that you're saying that because I also do the same in my practice, albeit differently. So a diet, we might give a therapeutic intervention of a diet mm-hmm. and someone might feel amazing. Like the lights have been turned on, everything's brighter, there's mm-hmm. more color. And then after 3 months, it's not the same anymore, mm-hmm. right? Or 6 months or 9 months, whatever the time the delta is. And so it's time now to modify the diet based on like the diet that's going to heal you, let's say when you're sick or help to heal you when you're sick is not the same diet you're going to follow for maintenance. And I think that what you're saying here is a parallel insofar as we might start off with something, but have the cognitive flexibility, even if you feel like your brain fog and you're not like thinking straight, just have the somewhere in the back of your mind somewhere that this might need to change as I get better, stronger, or as my body changes, as I get older, et cetera, that there's going to be some flux in terms of what the dosage might be. We might take things away. We might add things on.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right. So that's sort of a typical, and I sort of said I wanted to ask like the outliers as well. So I had a question come in from my community. I was like, I gotta ask this to MC. So should someone start hormones prophylactically? So she's not experiencing any symptoms that mm-hmm. we've been talking about. No sleep disturbances. She feels fine.
She feels great.
What is your rubric for thinking about a patient like this insofar as should we get her, let's say she's 48 or 49. So we know there's changes to progesterone. We know there's changes to estrogen in her body in terms of the amount.
We're certain she's statistically almost impossible at 48 for you not to be somewhere in perimenopause.
Right, right.
Different conversation than I'm having with someone at 35, right?
Correct, yes.
So we know she's there, even though, God bless her, she feels great, And probably that's a combination of genetics and lifestyle, that she's kind of breezing through this. But let me tell you, for mental health, bone health, and brain health, starting in perimenopause seems to be critical. It is the time of away from estrogen where the disease starts. It's less to do about your age and more to do with how long did you suffer? How long were you having to go without estrogen? We have therapeutic windows of opportunity to have these protective benefits of estrogen for heart disease and neuroprotection. And once you get to a certain point, estrogen is better at prevention than cure. So once those plaques form in the intima and you start having those calcified, estrogen is not going to be helpful to you. And it may be harmful if you have advanced disease. So we want to get you early. So my daughter is 23 years old. She is a first year medical student, and she is completely, now she's a little radical because me, but she has told me, I will not go without estrogen unless studies change and the world blows up, which happens occasionally. But she says, Mom, why would I allow my body to be away from estrogen? Why would I do this to myself? You know, why would I let myself suffer a little? You know, like, why do you have to, why are we waiting until people are symptomatic? This is a safe, helpful medication for the vast majority of patients. You know, there's this theory, there's this pervasive, you know, narrative that estrogen is harmful. We have it our whole lives until menopause. It's not inherently carcinogenic.
And then we suffer.
Balanced with progesterone, it is not carcinogenic.
Yeah.
We don't get breast cancer in pregnancy by and large. It happens very, very, very rarely to people with very specific genetic issues. But the vast majority of pregnancy, you never think about breast cancer. You know, that's not a thing. That's when your estrogen levels are the absolute highest. We don't see this dramatic or any increase in breast cancer. It's still incredibly rare. When do we see breast cancer? When your estrogen is the lowest. Now, estrogen might feed a breast cancer, right? If you retain your estrogen receptors through the malignant transformation, we all start out with healthy breast cells. And for some of us, we're born with without our tumor suppressor genes. I mean, you know, we know this, but I don't think your listeners really kind of get this. We all get cancer every single day. Then the cells that divide rapidly and in our body, the gut, the vagina, the anywhere, we get cancer. And our immune system immediately shuts it down. It recognizes those new proteins as foreign and kills that cell, okay? What happens in cancer that we pick up is that we've escaped that either through a combination of environmental factors, or we were born without the suppressor genes, or we were born with oncogenes, genes that promote cancer. And so, but we really do get cancer every day. And our body just swoops in and takes care of it before it ever even is more than a one or two cell division. And if you think of that way, you know, it makes more sense. So if you retain your estrogen receptor through the malignant transformation, they can use that receptor to help kill the cancer cell. And that's where tamoxifen and the estrogen blockers, the aromatase inhibitors, that's why they work. But it doesn't mean that estrogen caused your breast cancer.
Right. And I think, and I'm quoting this from your book, the British Menopause Society released findings based on an evaluation of updated science. The evidence reviewed suggested no increased risk of recurrence with MHT in women with early stage endometrial cancer, squamous cell carcinoma of the cervix, adenocarcinoma of the cervix, which is just cervical cancer, vaginal or vulval cancer. Mm-hmm. Evidence also shows no adverse effects on survival rates with hormone therapy in women with epithelial ovarian cancer as well.
Absolutely correct.
Yeah. And the only, and I'm just reading this, so I'm looking just off camera for a moment, on women with a history of breast cancer, their conclusion was that it should be a contraindication to the use of systemic MHT.
So,
so let's expand on that a little bit.
Yeah. So it depends. If you're a breast cancer survivor, I have to tell you, the answer should never be 100% no for everyone. It may be a no. Okay. But
you're not, there's not an automatic DQ. Like, you're not automatically disqualified.
Right.
I know
plenty of OBGYNs who are breast cancer survivors who have gone through treatment and therapy and are now cancer-free, who are on HRT because they know, because of their early menopause, that they are increased risk for stroke, osteoporosis, GSM. You know, every single woman can have vaginal estrogen. All of us, no matter what kind of cancer you have. It is absolutely safe.
Well, because that's not systemic too. Like,
it's local. Local therapy.
Let's distinguish between, I forgot to ask you that. So this is, I'm so glad that you said that. Mm-hmm. Let's distinguish between systemic hormone therapy and local.
Right. So a good analogy is topical cortisone that you get at Walgreens versus prednisone. Okay, we have local therapy. You just put where you need it and it really doesn't get absorbed systemically. You'd have to bathe in it. It's such a low dose versus something you put in your body, goes into your bloodstream and filters throughout your entire body. That is systemic menopause hormone therapy versus vaginal hormone therapy. And there's not been an increased risk of anything shown with vaginal estrogen.
Anything.
Anything.
Yeah. And that's a really big part of menopause. A lot of women, low libido, pain with sex, mm-hmm. you know, anorgasmia,
UTIs, right. Treatment and recurrent UTIs in a menopausal woman is vaginal estrogen. All these little old ladies who are getting multiple hospital admissions for UTIs and all these rounds of antibiotics, it is a travesty. They just did, the urologists who do a lot of female medicine, Rachel Rubin, Kelly Casperson, one of Rachel's team did an analysis and found that they would save Medicare $22 billion a year if they put every single menopausal woman on vaginal estrogen for the money that they would save. It would cut down UTIs and urosepsis 50%.
With a B, 22, that was $22 billion
a year.
With a B, yeah. What about CIRMs? What about designer estrogens, let's say? Yeah. I talked about this a little bit with Lisa on the
show.
She's
all into that. Yeah. So right now are so cool. So we have CIRMs that are used for bone density. There's one CIRM that is used for vaginal atrophy, for GSM. I can never remember these complicated generic names, but it's a pill you take every day. So CIRMs means selective estrogen reuptake modulator. So basically it's like a designer estrogen that binds to certain things but won't bind to others because we have alpha and beta estrogen receptors in different tissues. So there's one called basodoxifene, which is in the MHT medication called Duavi, which has estrogen. So it has Premarin, basically, plus this basodoxifene. Basodoxifene does not bind. It binds and blocks in the uterus and in the breast. So it spares
all the places we would want it blocked.
It spares the uterus and breast.
Yeah.
But then it binds in the brain and the bones and everywhere else in your body. And not only does it bind, it seems to downregulate the receptors there. So there's some interest in looking at it for if you have a postmenopausal breast cancer survivor who's interested in hormone therapy, that may be one of the ones she might want to consider. And so for my patients who are not tolerating progesterone at all, Duavi is one of the ones that I recommend.
How would someone not tolerate progesterone? Is it just the dose is too high? I mean,
Sometimes it's dose. Sometimes it's just they feel like they're hungover or they, have a reaction, we think, to the oil. It's peanut oil. So if they have a peanut allergy, it's a no-go. You know, if they have there's a few people that just don't feel well on it, you know, for whatever reason. And hopefully we'll figure that out one day. And, you know, so we can switch them to like Clumpy Patch or something with a synthetic progestin, or we can consider one of the CIRMs. You know, the Duavi that has a CIRM, it doesn't have progesterone, so they're not going to get the sleep benefit. But if that's not really an issue, then, and especially if they're a breast cancer survivor, we may want to consider going the route of Duavi.
When we're thinking about combo therapy, so, you know, my understanding of it, and feel free to redirect me here if I'm incorrect, but my understanding is when we are taking an estrogen, if you have a uterus, it would be a good idea to have progesterone to oppose, let's say, the effects that estrogen might have.
Unopposed estrogen in a woman with a uterus who doesn't have a Mirena IUD or progestin-containing IUD puts her at increased risk for hyperplasia and endometrial cancer. So we can negate that by giving her a progestogen with her estrogen. Now, that could be local in the form of the IUD, or it could be systemic in the form of progesterone. One other option is the Duavi, which is a CIRM because you're not binding in the endometrium.
Well, that was where I was thinking as you were talking. I'm like, well, is progesterone then optional? Could it potentially be optional if you do have a uterus, let's say, and for whatever reason, the progesterone isn't doing it for you, maybe feel hungover, as you were saying, you know, a patient reports not feeling like they're all there, or maybe they're too flaccid or whatever, or maybe it's the peanut oil. Progesterone might then be optional if you're able to use some of these CIRMs not. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That's so interesting. I love that. Okay. So let's think about, we talked about the 48-year-old, let's say, who is not symptomatic yet. What about the woman who missed the boat? So she was going through perimenopause and menopause. She's 70 years old. Mm-hmm. The recommendation at the time of her menopause was absolutely not. This is going to kill you. Is it too late for her to profit from some of the... Not necessarily. Okay.
So it's always going to protect your bones. it will always protect your general urinary system. But we can kind of get around that with vaginal estrogen. But you know who comes to me like really worried are the healthy, active woman with osteoporosis. And she wants to talk about it in her 60s and 70s. So what do we know? If we put estrogen on top of cardiovascular disease, we can make that worse. So I do a complete cardiac workup for her. So we're getting a, you know, cholesterol panel, looking at her hypertension, all the risk factors for cardiovascular disease. And if any of those pop up, I'm getting a calcium cardiac score. And if that looks good, and then the AHA, American Heart Association, just published looking at their ASCCD score, ASCVD score. I have the app on my phone, so I'll run that with the patient. That basically gives them a risk. So if they're above 10%, they're not recommending hormone therapy. But to me, it's the calcium cardiac score. We're looking to see if they have calcifications, you know, around the carotid, in the carotids or in the around the heart. And so one of the caveats to also think about is stroke risk. So we know that estrogen in any form, whether it's oral or transdermal, will make platelets a little stickier. So, and in the older studies, when birth control pills first came out, they were ultra high dose, right? They were like 50 mics of ethanol estradiol. And so, you know, we saw a slight increase risk of stroke. And so they started backing down on the dose. Turns out you only need 20, maybe 15, sometimes 10 mics to suppress ovulation. So we don't need to go that high. But that data kind of carried down to menopause hormone therapy, which is a fraction of that amount. But so there's always this caution. They did find in the WHI that after 7 years of therapy, women on in either arm had an increased risk, a slight increased risk of stroke. So what the experts think is that if you're prone to it and you have pre-existing disease, putting a sticky platelet through a narrowed, you know, cerebral artery is, you know, probably going to increase your risk, but it's still very, very, very small. So I always talk about that. And this is not you're going to have a stroke. This is after a certain amount of time, after a certain age, you know, we might increase your risk of stroke. It's very small, but, you know, these are all the conversations I have with my patients.
Well, that's also, you know, I'm just thinking sort of, it's just Poisson distribution as well. Like the longer you take, like the longer you're around, the higher the likelihood that there's going to be some incident that might be related to the estrogen therapy. That might also be a function of aging, and there could be other multifactorial components to that. And I would also maybe add in as well, and this is, I did this on my solo episode with the WHI, like all the participants were relative, like they were well past menopause.
Yeah, average age was 62 in the WHI. Yes. They had some 50-year-olds, thank God, because that's where we get the best data from, or the, you know, the safety data and the cardiovascular data. But they had women as old as 79 who were in the study starting.
Right. And they had
probably
smokers.
Already had these diseases, and now we're putting estrogen on top of it.
Right.
So these are the very nuanced conversations I have with these patients at that age. But these, you know, so she comes in, she's, you know, 69 and like just got the diagnosis of osteoporosis. She's like, what can I do? We go through, you know, collagen supplementation, heavy, you know, lifting heavy, doing protein intake, you know, all the things we know, weighted vest, vibratory training. I go through all the tools in the toolkit for osteoporosis. And then we have a very direct conversation about hormone therapy. Risks versus benefits. And some of them do choose to try it. We do a very low dose. There have been studies that shown the lowest patch we have commercially available is 0.025. They've actually done studies with a 0.01, even, you know, less than half of that. Mm-hmm. And it did show bone protection. So, but again, lifestyle is key as well.
Foot mechanics affect every aspect of your fitness and your movement patterning. When we are wearing shoes with a built-in arch support, lots of cushioning, we are affecting the mechanics of the entire lower limb and spine. These types of shoes will shorten the Achilles tendon, they will limit ankle dorsiflexion, they cause more arch collapse, they limit toe flexion and abduction, which causes bunions, they affect your ability to squat properly, and your ankle and knees have to take up the slack of a foot that isn't moving the way it should. I have recently swapped my running shoes and have been wearing Puluva shoes as my day shoe, still training barefoot, and I've loved it. Puluva helps to restore foot mechanics, giving your feet the room to move, which improves posture, your gait, your natural body movement, and for me, it's helping my squat. Go to Puluva.com/Dr. Stephanie to get 10% off of your entire order. That's Puluva.com/DrStephanie to save 10%. Let's talk a little bit about the toolkit. So you mentioned a couple things. I've seen you on Instagram with your weighted vest on your treadmill, which yeah. I love to see. And I think you also, was I watching you? I was stalking your Instagram the other day. I think you were jumping. Were you doing box jumps?
I was jumping off a box just to stimulate bone strength.
Awesome.
So I don't like jumping off a box. Sometimes I pee
awesome,
a little.
Though. It's awesome. Yeah. Oh, that's funny.
Sometimes
too,
if my bladder's full, it's not going to go well for me.
Right. It's not going to go well. Absolutely. So what are some of the things that you like to think about? So we've been talking a lot about hormone therapy, and we'll continue it because I do want to talk a little bit more about myth busting and all of that. But when, and you talk about this in your book as well, how can we major in the majors, right? So what are some of the major verticals, the top buckets that you like to think about as a menopausal woman in terms of brain, you know, health, bone health, body composition? What are the things that you engage in every day and you're recommending with your patients?
So when, you know, my toolkit is nutrition, movement, which is exercise, pharmacology, supplementation, stress reduction, sleep optimization. So when you look at organ systems, and so what I do in the book is I break down, like, what can you do about mental health? You know, what do we know what helps with mental health across all those, all that spectrum of the toolkit? What do we know helps with brain cognition? What do we know helps with asthma? What do we know, you know? And you see these themes recurring over and over and over again. So, like, top heavy hitters that are going to affect multiple organ systems and make you healthier. Well, one is HRT. Okay, we'll throw that. So say you can't do that. What else can you do? Fiber. I cannot tell you, this is the most undersung, the hero that no one, you know, so many of us don't think about, is we are not getting enough fiber as Americans in our diet per day. We need 25 as women, 32 as men, minimum. And most Americans are getting, like, the bottom quartile, like 5 grams, like nothing. You know, people who live in food deserts who are, don't have access to fresh food are getting 5 to 10. Average is 12 grams, half of what
so
we
half,
need.
Half, yeah.
Fiber
yeah.
feeds our gut microbiome. The food that fiber comes in is also rich in minerals, vitamins, nutrients. You know, fiber-rich foods have so many other benefits outside of just having fiber. It keeps us full longer. It makes us more satiated. Our leptin and ghrelin are more in line. It helps with insulin resistance. It slows the uptake of glucose into the cells. It makes it a more steady state rise instead of these big shifts. So fiber, like, number one. Number two, vitamin D. You know, most of my patients are severely deficient in vitamin D, and that's one of the first things we tackle.
And you can live in Florida and be deficient in vitamin D.
So our gut changes dramatically as we age, with aging and with menopause, and we just can't absorb it the way we used to. And then the estrobilome changes, which is how our metabolites shift in, you know, and how we reabsorb certain estrogen metabolites. So everything is affected by this. So fiber, vitamin D, watching your added sugars. Sugar's got a bad rap in the keto movement. And some of them for a very good reason. You know, we are eating too many added sugars in our diet to keep us healthy. The average is 100. Added sugars are the sugars added in cooking and processing, not fruits and vegetables. So if you just ignore the fruits and veggies and dairy and the natural forms of sugar that is found naturally in food, and you just look at the added sugars through the cooking, processing, and alcohol, if you limit those to 25 grams or less per day, you do way better. Women who do that consistently have less visceral fat, less heart attacks, all of it. So that's another thing we focus on. Magnesium, we tend to, you know, magnesium is an electrolyte that we excrete in the urine every day. So it's, we don't really get a steady state, not like we do with vitamin D, which is fat soluble and we have storage for it. We don't have storage for magnesium in our body. But most Americans are not getting enough daily nutritional magnesium. This is one that's pretty easy to supplement. But there's a whole lot out there. There's certain magnesium formulations that don't actually are bioavailable and they cause diarrhea. We use them as doctors for bowel preps, you know, before a colonoscopy or for milk of magnesia to cause diarrhea, you know, to soften your stools. So, but other forms of magnesium are very readily bioavailable, and even others will cross the blood-brain barrier. So when I'm recommending magnesium, I'm usually recommending those that are going to get into your brain too,
because
they seem to really help with sleep. Yeah, the L3 and 8. They seem to really help with sleep. They help with the SSRI-resistant depression, and they seem to help with some anxiety. So turmeric can be really powerful, you know, loading up your plate with antioxidants, anti-inflammatory, and if you are in a culture where you cook a lot with turmeric, great. You know, it's not something that's hugely bioavailable. So when it's processed into pill form, it's usually added with black pepper extract. So that will increase the bioavailability uptake. But it is, you know, there's some pretty good studies versus placebo that show, you know, decreasing blood pressure, decreasing visceral fat, and even decreased hot flashes in some patients.
What is your targets for vitamin D and magnesium? So magnesium, you said, you know, obviously.
So the blood levels, you know, are really, they fluctuate so much. I never do a magnesium blood level.
Sure.
So I'm telling, you know, 260, you know, we look at her dietary intake. So I have them track their food and we look at how much they're getting naturally. You can, but it's hard to OD on mag, you know, because we excrete it so quickly. And so I'm telling them, you know, 260 to 350-ish, you know, daily is going to keep you probably tanked up and out of trouble.
And you'll know when you're reaching your tolerance too. Like you're going to start to see changes in your stool. There's going to be cramping. You're going to have loose stool. Mm-hmm. Like you're not, you know if you're taking too much.
You're backing off. But again, let me say all of this with a caveat when I talk about supplements. If you have a perfect diet, you shouldn't need any supplements, but that's just not real life, you know?
And I don't know if that's possible. I have to, with our food system, I mean, I don't know if it's possible.
We were not evolving as a species with supplements readily available. Now, certainly we died from a lot of stuff, but, you know, you really should fight to get your nutrition from food, and we supplement gaps or to give us, you know, extra help in certain areas. So, you know, my background in nutrition, that's got to be, you can't swallow a handful of supplements and make poor nutritional choices and think that you're doing a good job at anything.
Right.
That's the fallacy.
Right.
So good food should be the core of what you do.
So 260 to 350 mgs for magnesium, vitamin D, what's a target that you're looking for?
So you can safely take 4,000 IUs a day without worries of toxicity. Some people need more. So I'm trying to get her to a 60 level or above, like a blood level of at least 60.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. And like I've had patients where I've run lab and they you can do it in Florida because they live in Miami and you would think they're going to get sun, but we don't. We stay indoors all day. We sip our coffee by the window.
Yeah. I mean, we protect ourselves for sunscreen. Yep. I mean, for good reason. And it's just really, really hard for people to get the amount that they need in their diet. That's a really tough one.
What do you think about creatine?
I love creatine. Love it because they've done some really, really nice studies in elderly ladies and looking at women with osteoporosis. So creatine was synergistic with protein intake and resistance training in the elderly. And so I'm almost qualified for elderly. This is data I want. And when they look at women, I get really excited. And so I take creatine every day in part of my osteoporosis prevention program.
And
now I'm also eating
mgs?
The protein. I'm doing the work.
Yes. You're box jumping with your weighted vest on. Yeah.
And yeah, I do five milligrams.
Yes. And then you are, and that's really awesome. And when we look at the bodybuilding community, even those who get up on stage and they're competing, like they never stop taking creatine because they are dieting down. I mean, I'm not recommending you do this, but they train so much. But at that point when they're getting ready for a show, all they're trying to do is preserve their muscle tissue. And so they keep their protein targets the same and they never go off creatine, never. Mm-hmm. You know, they're going to cut out all the fats and all the carbs and all the other things, which I'm not saying is healthy. Please don't do that. But I'm just saying we can learn a lot from people who their primary occupation is preserving lean muscle mass, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, how big can I look for a show while eating almost no calories, which is not healthy in and of itself. But they are also dosing up, their protein stays consistent. It doesn't change off season, on season. And the creatine also stays consistent, which I think is important as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Protein. Lots of conversation about protein as of late, which is lovely.
So
what do you think about protein?
When I rewrite Galveston diet and probably call it something that's not a diet, I really think about protein very different now. So now in my patient population, when they come in and I'm trying to set macro goals for them, we're protein centric. So the first thing I do is I look at because I have a body scanner in my office and I'm measuring muscle mass. So if they're sarcopenic, they're coming in with low muscle mass, we're going higher on a certain scale. So I figure out their ideal body weight in kilograms, you know, based on ideal muscle mass and ideal body fat. And my machine helps me figure that out. And I'm going 1.5 to 2-ish, you know, grams per kilogram of lean body mass per day. If she's sarcopenic, we're going higher. A lot of my obese patients have great muscle mass because guess what? they have to work a lot harder than someone who has less body fat to do daily life activities. And most of them are fairly active. They just carry more fat. And so that fat is like a weighted vest. And so, you know, where I get worried is when they have sarcopenic obesity. That's a whole different discussion. You know, that's a metabolic train wreck and we have very intensive conversation. But most patients who are overweight actually have really good muscle mass because they're responding to the excess load and it's working and they're not calorically restricting. So they're getting plenty of protein. So we just kind of rework those macros for them. So I'm going 1.5-ish to 2, depending on their body composition. So that could look like anywhere from like, depending on her height, you know, I had a 6 foot tall, 180 pound, perfectly healthy woman coming in who was like just incredible. And so she needed a lot more protein. And then, but usually it's somewhere 100, 120, somewhere in there. Sometimes if she's petite, you know, it might be in the high 90s.
And I think it also depends too on, you know, how much resistance training is she doing. So I typically, so I'm 46 right now and I typically, and I usually have somewhere between 150 and 170 grams of protein, which is well above the two, you know,
That's amazing. I don't know how you do it.
I'm in touch with my inner whey protein.
My
whey protein shakes. That really helps me, like 1.5 scoops, like 37 grams, you know, protein right there. So very, very, very easy to get that number in. But I also train a lot too, right? So I'm training a lot at the gym and my muscles require that.
I also stalk you on Instagram and I'm like, you have the most beautiful back. I'm like, that is my goal. I want 70s back.
Thank you. Yeah. I love lifting heavy. I grew up in the cardio bunny. Like I also grew up in the cardio machine room and, you know, and it was like, you know, look like Kate Moss, like everything that you could do to look like this.
And you're healthy.
My point is that I sort of grew up with like, try to make your thighs not touch. And I remember at one point, like I don't know how long I had been on that damn elliptical. And I was like, you know what? My thighs are just never going to touch. Like, I'm just going to accept the fact I'm never going to be skinny. Like, I got curves. It's just how my body's built. But I think that there's this sort of shift, and I've heard you talk about this as well, which I really love, which is moving away from this, like, cardio bunny, how can I get as skinny and as tiny and as teeny tiny as I can, to really moving that mind shift to being more, with the biceps. If you're listening on audio, she just had a beautiful flex of her biceps. So like how we can move from skinny to strong, which I really, and I think for a type A personality or someone like yourself, or I'll include myself in that bucket as well, it's, you can gamify it, right? It's like, how strong can I get? How much can I curl? How much can I bench press? How much can I pull up? You know, like it becomes this kind of internal game to see how far you can progress too.
I've had to hire a trainer to come in, because when I first made this decision, I just went completely overboard and tore something. And, you know, be gentle. You can get there, but you need to start with the 5 pound weights and then work your way up. Don't Mary Claire just pick up the 20 pounders. You're going to do something. Don't start throwing kettlebells around without having a good base to start with.
So. I love that. That's also very, very sage advice. I think if you are someone who is active, certainly injury is something that we think about, especially if you don't, if you haven't been lifting weights for many years, right? You don't have that mind muscle connection. You don't have that, you know, what we would call neuromechanical integrity. Like you don't have basically the connection between the brain and the muscle. I'm actually working with my son right now. He does competitive soccer, and I'm trying to get him to turn on his glutes because, you know, he's like every other kid sitting on his butt for, you know, 8 hours and he comes home and he's on Snapchat or whatever crap else I'm trying to get him off of. And he's like always sitting, right? So it's like, you need to wake them up or else they're going to go to sleep, right? So, the point being, not that you're, our audience here is teenage boys, but like, I think many of us spend a lot of our time sitting at a desk, at a computer, we're sitting most of the day. And then we go to the gym and we're like, well, I'm just going to put on 3 plates on the barbell and see what happens with this squat. Yeah. And then it's sort of a recipe, to your point, for injury. Wonderful. Okay. So I thought the other thing I wanted to make sure that we've been sort of dancing around a little bit, but I wanted to actually just have a little sort of true, false, if you will, in terms of myths around menopause. So I sort of mentioned one before. Mm-hmm. Having endometriosis or adenomyosis, is that an automatic DQ for MHT?
Absolutely not. It comes with caveat. Again, an intense discussion. You must give high-dose progesterone with someone who has a history of endometriosis because there is a small risk of reactivating an endometrial implant, especially if you're going in the middle of perimenopause, you know, and you're not waiting to have kind of decimation of that tissue. And so there's a few small, just a few, but enough, you know, case reports of reactivation of endometriosis from unopposed MHT, meaning estrogen only, because they've had their extirpative surgery. So for patients, even if you've had a THBSO or hysterectomy for the treatment of your endometriosis, you still, you know, and you've had your ovaries removed, you still should receive progesterone and at higher doses to tampen down potentially any potential reactivation. So as long as you understand that, go for it.
We've talked about breast cancer. What about a family history of heart disease or liver disease?
Make it stop, please. Family history of nothing will disqualify you of anything, nothing. I mean, there's nothing in your family history that will disqualify you from MHT. Now, if you have a high-risk genetic condition, that's different than my grandma had it, okay? And so it is only you having active cardiovascular disease in the form of a calcified plaque and chest pain inside of your chest, you know, where we're like, nope, it's not for you at this point. But a family history, it's protective. We know from the WHI, starting hormone therapy within the first 10 years of your menopause will protect you from cardiovascular disease. That makes you more of a candidate if you have a family history.
Yes. What about an increased risk of clotting?
So you just want to avoid oral, as we spoke of earlier. We right. can negate that. You still have an increased risk of clotting because of your history. I'm not going to make it worse by giving you a non-oral form of estrogen.
Beautiful. And then last one, history of migraine headaches with aura and migraine headaches without aura.
No change of migraines without aura. More nuanced discussion with aura. The aura represents vasospasm. Okay, so it's all theoretical. There's not actually been a study that showed women with aura on menopause hormone therapy dosing have an increased risk of stroke. We know that women with aura have an increased risk of stroke in general, and they're worried that when we add on, remember we talked about that slight increased risk after several years.
Yeah.
And so it really is a risk-benefit analysis between you and the patient, looking at other aspects of her health, looking at the whole health. We are ignoring the potential benefits of estrogen therapy outside of the hot flashes, okay? We're not having the conversation around osteoporosis. We're not having the conversation around neuroprotection or cardiovascular disease protection. And we're allowing the fear of breast cancer to drive the majority of healthcare decisions for women in this country, and it is ridiculous. We are more than our breasts. Now, I'm very serious about breast cancer, and I don't want to get it, which is why I completely limited my alcohol intake, which is a much bigger risk factor than hormone therapy.
Mm-hmm. That is something that I don't understand why are we not screaming this, that every single glass of alcohol you have, and it's not winding you down at all. It's actually, you're flooding the liver with sugar. You're going to have a distorted and disrupted sleep. And as you know, as you just mentioned, it's going to rev up your inflammation and also predisposition and risk for breast cancer. Like why this is not, you know, we always hear, and it's so funny, we hear it in, it's like it's 5 o'clock somewhere, it's 1 o'clock. It's like, no, you don't need to do that. You don't need to have a glass of wine.
It is the rare patient who is able to tolerate alcohol the way she could in her premenopausal years.
Right.
There's hopefully new emerging research on why this is happening. Yep. People think it has to do with our body composition changes or whatever, but we are not in general, there's a few outliers out there as there is anything, tolerating alcohol the same way. It is so sleep disruptive at any point of our life, but especially in menopause. And for me and for so many of my friends and patients, even one glass of whatever, especially wine, because the sugar, 3 a.m. wake up, guaranteed.
Mm-hmm. So we've been talking about the benefits of MHT, of menopause hormone therapy. Let's just talk about some of the side effects.
Yeah,
So we've been talking about, and we've been nuancing the conversation throughout with like, do you have a uterus? Don't you? You have endometriosis, et cetera. But what are some of the common side effects someone might experience when they're starting out their hormone therapy journey? What are some things to look out for? What are things that we have to absolutely make sure that we're having a discussion with our primary healthcare provider about?
So 50% of women will have unscheduled bleeding when they start menopause hormone therapy. And the earlier you are in your menopause journey, the more likely that is to happen. So that would just look like spotting, maybe a period when you weren't expecting it. That is normal. That is expected. We are waking up tissue that's been sleeping for a little while. It doesn't quite know what to do. There are definitely dose adjustments we can make if it becomes persistent, but you don't need a workup, which is ultrasound biopsy, if this is in the beginning of your therapy, like in that first year, until you've gone 6 months and we've changed the doses and it's still happening, then you should go get an ultrasound and a workup. Now, if you've been on hormone therapy successfully with no bleeding for a year or two and everything's great, and then all of a sudden you have some bleeding, you should let your doctor know immediately and go get that worked up. But in the early stages, in that first year, we're going to see about 50% of women have some bleeding. It's annoying. It scares everyone. I try to reassure them, tell them this might happen before they start the meds so that they're ready. So that's kind of the biggest thing. The next thing is, you know, if you start having new onset of any neurological changes, usually in the form of headaches or visual changes, stop your meds immediately, stop estrogen immediately, and call your doctor. That needs to be evaluated. Very, very rare, but, you know, it's something to worry about. Breast tenderness can be a problem. Again, we're stimulating hormonally sensitive tissue that's still sitting there. And, you know, I still have it occasionally from time to time with no changes in my hormonal regimen. But it's not, you know, I know it's there. It's not really bothersome. But for some women, it's really, really tender and painful. So we can decrease estrogen doses from that. Some women may see increasing in headaches. You know, the estrogen withdrawal is really a powerful instigator of some migraine headaches or headaches. So you want to let your doctor know about that. And those are kind of really the big ones that we see.
That's good to know. And like, I started off this conversation saying, you know, we want to talk about hormone therapy so that we can sort of predict for the patient what might happen. Mm-hmm. Because if there's some vaginal bleeding and no one has said to them, hey, you might have vaginal bleeding, they're going to freak out. Mm-hmm. So I think that that's really important. And the last area that I wanted to just discuss with you is finding a doctor. So this is going to be...
I wish you could walk into your primary care provider or your OB-GYN or your whoever clinician and say, hey, let's talk about menopause. Because the reality is, of the trainees we're graduating right now, only 7% feel competent. That doesn't mean they are competent, that feel competent in treating a menopausal woman, even though they admit it's important. They just didn't receive the training.
Right.
So what do you do?
Yeah, what's a gal to do?
So you can go to the Menopause Society at menopause.org and look for certified providers on their website. They have a list. So that's one option. Still not a guarantee, but it's better than nothing. We have a list of providers on our website. It's basically testimonials from my followers who were sweet enough to give the name, address. We just confirmed that they're practicing medicine. So you can try that.
So that's at thepauselife.com.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then there are some great telemedicine providers, I have to say. And I've vetted several of them, and there's three that kind of really stand out to me, and they do not pay me to say this. They're MIDI, Alloy Health, and Evernow. And MIDI takes insurance.
These are American. I'll also throw in Felix for Canada. Mm-hmm. They are also offering sort of telemedicine for menopausal healthcare as well. Yeah.
So I'm fighting at the level of the American Board, the American College, to try to get menopause as a curriculum, and we can really start training our residents. I'm doing 12 lectures to different grand rounds and medical schools on menopause. It's only an hour, but it's better than nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. I wanted to ask you, so you mentioned your daughter, I believe you said she's 24, mm-hmm. first year med student. By the time she's 54, what do you hope has changed?
So there's some really exciting research going on right now that hopefully will make menopause optional. And it's looking at certain pharmacologics that will extend the shelf life of the ovary, not so that you'll get pregnant again, but just to create enough estrogen to keep you healthy so you don't suffer from the estrogen deprivation and all the ensuing health. So you'll kind of age like a man.
Is this like a genetic modification, stem cell therapy?
No, is more looking at AMH and how to increase the levels. AMH is kind of, they think, one of the precursors to that, where we see the acceleration of the decline of egg supply. And so I think there's Ovarium is one of the companies. I've met with two of the, you know, for the book, because I wanted to talk, I mentioned briefly in the book. But, and I was just on stage at South by Southwest with another, she's Boss Ovary on Instagram. You can follow her. It's pretty fascinating.
A great name.
They are not happy about the grandmother hypothesis.
They're not. Okay.
Those PhDs. Yeah.
That's cool. I want to look her. I love her handle. Boss
Ovary. Boss Ovary. Yeah. Yeah, that's great. So, and then Daisy Robinson, she has the other company. So those are the two big ones. I'm sure there's more out there coming, but there's a lot of innovation around, should menopause be an option? So I would love to see my daughter's generation get to the point where they can choose to take a medication or have some kind of procedure that will just, you know, keep their ovaries functioning for longer.
Yeah. I love that as well. And I think, you know, now with the information that we have, I talk a lot about this idea, like, I want to be a kick-ass 95-year-old. Like,
I want to be that grandma rolling down the hill with my grandkids and climbing, yeah, putting them on a backpack and taking them up the mountain. Why should that not happen?
Right. I love that idea. I love, and dare I say, I knew my great-grandmother. I would love for that to also be an option for me to see my lineage and to be able to be functional, have the cognitive faculties, the physical faculties to be able to interact with my family. So that's, yeah.
My 20-year-old only remembers my grandmother demented in a bed for 5 years. That's her only memory of her.
Right.
And that's what I don't want.
Well, I hope that your new book is absolutely going to give some options for women. So please plug the book and where people can find you on the gram, on the interwebs. Tell us where we can find
you. So the book is called The New Menopause, and it's available for pre-order or order everywhere you buy books. Please try to support your local booksellers. And you can find me all over social media at Dr. Mary Claire or Dr. Mary Claire Haver.
Wonderful. And we'll have all those as clickable links in the show notes. Mary Claire, it's wonderful to see you again and to spend this time. This has been wonderful. Thank you.
All right. Take care.